This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Mike Jurgen. How are you, Mike?
I'm doing great, Chris. What's going on?
Not a lot. Well, we're recording this just after Christmas, so not a lot at the moment. I've just been swimming, actually. So we're going to be talking about your Bouton Wine Company, which people say, well, that sounds like a nice name, but tell me, what is the Bouton Wine Company and where are you?
So the Kingdom of Bhutan is a tiny little monarchy in the Himalayas. It's sometimes referred to as the happiest place on earth or the last Shangri-La. And it is renowned for their approach to sustainable agriculture. And it is the only carbon negative country in the world. So really just cool, magical place to go. And I started the wine industry there about 7 years ago. We've been building the wine industry out for about the last 7 years in a place that has never had vinifera before. So pretty exciting project.
Yeah, no, it sounds good. And do you want to tell us where Bhutan is? Because one of the things we want to talk about today, one of the main things I'm interested in is one of the regions has a double harvest. So we're going to talk about that. But I think we really need to sort of get a feel for where Bhutan is, because if they're like me, they need to look it up on a map. So you said that it's in the Himalayas. So that implies it's near China or India, or where is it?
Yeah, so it's about the size of Switzerland, and it's essentially it's not quite round, but it's more or less round. So it's about, you know, that big. It technically borders only India and China. Those are the only two countries it shares a border with, but it really is more like between Tibet and Nepal, and it's about the same size as Tibet and Nepal. The base of the country is against the Himalayas, and then it just goes straight up the side of the Himalayas. So in the south, the altitude's about 300 feet. And then in the north, the altitude goes up to about 25,000 feet. And that span, that north to south span, is about 300 miles. So in a very short amount of time, you go from basically flat nothing to glaciers.
Okay, that does sound like you need to enjoy walking up hills.
There's a lot of hills, yeah. Matter of fact, the way I actually got there was I went to Bhutan to run a marathon, just because of specifically of that reason. And then when I got there, I realized, I'm like, oh, this place is perfect for wine. And I started looking for wineries and they didn't have any. So we created an industry. But yeah, okay. I went there to run hills.
It is a little bit far south, though. The latitude, I think you said earlier before we started, was 28 degrees latitude.
Yep.
And normally you're thinking 30, 50, but 28 degrees is on the warm side of the climate range, really, for a Vitis vinifera. Is altitude a big player? You're on a mount side of a mountain.
Understanding that Bhutan has not grown vinifera before, what we don't know is we don't know where the optimal climate zones are, and we don't know what varietals will work the best. And so we tried to study it analytically and got nowhere. And so we decided to try planting stuff and see what would happen. And so my lowest altitude vineyard is at about 300 feet. My highest altitude vineyard is about 9,600 feet. So
what's it in meters? Sorry.
So like 100 meters to 3,200 meters, basically.
Yeah, okay. 3,200 meters, 3.2.
Correct.
That's up there with Salta in Cafachede. I mean, that's quite high.
Quite high, yep. And I also have vineyards at about 1,500 meters. I have vineyards at about 2,500 meters. And then the highest, I think, is about 32. So we're kind of trying everything. And within that, we've identified kind of four discrete climate zones that seem to work for growing vinifera, but they're very, very different in terms of what you do and how you do it and what varietals are going to work.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so being at 28 degrees latitude, you must have quite short days, relatively short growing days, I would have thought, compared to maybe, you know, 50 degrees latitude in summer, you've got long days, and the closer you get to the equator, the days get shorter and shorter with dark and night, I would have thought.
Yeah, we do. Like I said, the bigger issues for us are not the latitude, because I can sort of put vineyards on any aspect of a mountain in any sort of shape or form I want. And the vigor is spectacular. So we're less concerned about growing season days and more concerned about things like, how do you deal with monsoon pressure? And what's the appropriate trellising style? Should we move to pergola from VSP? And how do you control for things like wasps? Bhutan has one of the few wasp species in the world that's capable of biting through the skin of a grape. And they sure do like biting through the skin of grapes. Like, these are much more practical issues than the grapes are going to get ripe. We've seen no issues with that.
Yep.
Lots of other issues, but not that.
Yeah. And what sort of grape varieties are you growing? Because I had a look. I didn't recognize many of them.
Well, we're growing, we have 10 reds and 6 whites and then 2 hybrids. And the reds are all the international varietals that you would expect, right? It's Pinot, it's Cab Sav, Cab Franc, you know, Syrah, Malbec. The whites, all international varietals as well. Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc. The one kind of weird thing in the whites is we also planted Petit Mansang, which is obviously a little less international. And then the two hybrids that we're playing around with.
It's down bottom southwest, isn't it?
Jurançon is, in my opinion, a highly underrated and spectacular wine. And then we're also trying two hybrids, Traminette and Vidal.
Vidal, like in Canada, Vidal.
Like same Vidal.
Crikey, so it's
like if it grows in Canada, it'll probably grow on a glacier.
Yeah, that's quite a big range for Vidal, you know, because Canada is what, about 50, or some of the parts are about 50 degrees latitude, isn't it? And then you're going it all the way down. Why Vidal? Can it hold on to its acidity or something? Is that the...
The big issue for us, or one of the challenges that we have with Bhutan, is monsoon pressure in the summertime. And so Vidal tends to be quite powdery mildew resistant and fungally resistant. And so given the higher rain pressure, it's an interesting grape to try. My viticulturalist, my personal opinion is I think that Vidal makes a kind of a boring wine unless you're doing like an ice wine. But my viticulturalist assures me that I am underestimating the potential of Vidal. So we're trying it. We're going to see, you know? And I think what will happen, Chris, I think what's likely to happen is over the next 10 years, we're really going to figure out, like, climate zone A is really good for this. And climate zone B is really good for this. And we'll have, I don't know, you know, a mountain fruit Malbec. You know, we'll have a, you know, open flatland Vidal Blanc, and we'll do a sparkling from the really high altitude stuffs where getting grapes riper is a challenge. And I think that's what's going to happen.
Okay. And you said the disease pressure with the monsoon is your main issue. Is that just it's just wet, so you can't spray, it's always just raining and it's heavy rain, or is it?
It's heavy rain, and it's, and so when you spray, it kind of, you have to spray a lot. And the other challenge that we've got is, I mentioned that Bhutan was the only carbon negative country in the world, and they're really careful about sustainable agricultural practices. So we can't use kind of the high octane fungicides that we might if we were not in Bhutan. So not only am I spraying constantly, I have to spray weaker stuff.
Okay, yeah, because I was going to say, so some of the more modern fungicides aren't touch fungicides. They actually go into the leaf. And then that, and when the new bud comes out, where, you know, the growing bud, you know, that's already protected from fungus. And so you sort of got quite, you can't use any of the modern ones. So are you like going organic, or are you forced down the organic, or?
We're not forced down the organic path, but we're sort of organish, if that makes sense. And so there are chemicals that are approved in Bhutan, but not all of them are. And so we sort of have to be careful and pick and choose, you know, the most powerful ones that we can that are on the approved list.
Yeah. Okay. No, fair enough. Okay. So let's talk about, you've got an experimental vineyard. I think it's called Galifu or Glyphi?
Galifu.
Galifu. You've got it described as as an experimental vineyard. Why is it experimental and what's going on there?
Well, so when we first started working with the country to develop this, they were unconvinced that grapes would grow in their country. And so we ended up planting 6 experimental vineyards at different regions and different altitudes and different climate types to try to see if it would work. So this is one of those 6. It happens to be, in my opinion, maybe the most interesting of the 6 that we've got for a handful of reasons. not the least of which is it's in a tropical zone, which really changes what you can do with kind of flowering and fruiting and harvesting.
You mentioned that, that you get two crops, and that's the sort of thing I want to explore a little bit is this two crops. You know, you see places like there's some grapes in Brazil that are they're grown where they get two crops. I know in
Peru they're doing it as well. A little bit in Thailand. It's not unheard of, but it's not very common.
No. And I presume the reason you're getting two crops or you're trying, well, let me just say one other thing. The granite bout in Brisbane, up there, they can get two crops. But when I visited them years and years ago, and the thing that they said was they control it by pruning to try and stop the two crops. But let's just talk a wee bit about why you get two crops to start off with.
So the down there in that tropical zone, it's extremely warm. I would say in the summer, it can go as high as, let's say, 45 degrees Celsius. And in the winter, it's never going to get below. I got to do the conversion in my head. It's probably not going to get too much below, say, 20 degrees Celsius. So because of that, the vine does not enter a natural state of dormancy. It has the potential to just keep growing all year long. And then it sort of triggers off of other factors like irrigation and pruning and access to UV radiation and photosynthesis and stuff like that. So you can control it through a number of manners. Pruning certainly is one of them. There's also some chemicals that you can use called Dormax is the primary one that can be used to help, you know, control if and when the plant flowers.
Okay, so if you don't control the vine, does it just keep getting new nodes and shooting out new flowers?
Yeah.
And you'll end up with clusters that are at different parts of the growing cycle? Is that the case? Or does it sort of go through a full cycle and then start a new full cycle again?
I actually don't know because we've never done it. We've always controlled for it. But my understanding of the science behind it is that what you would get would be one full cycle and then that would stop and then you would get another full cycle. It was not like this side of the cordon is flowering in June and the other side is flowering in December. But I would bet that you would see probably clonal differences across vines. But generally speaking, you'd have one big cycle and then another big cycle.
And during that first cycle, things like the, because in the buds, the inflorescence or the flowers, they develop, normally what happens is the buds that we're going to get this year were developing last year in the summer before inside the bud. And then when the bud bursts, that immature flower is already there and it just sort of folds out and does its thing. So you're still getting the same process of the buds forming growing season before.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they're maturing inside the bud. And then at the end of the last fruiting, when the fruit's cleared from the vine, is it, do you then do like a winter prune at that point and then it just starts again?
It's more nuanced than that. So the first nuance that we've got is we're still figuring stuff out, right?
Yep.
This has not been done before. So because of that, we're experimenting with a lot of things that we know not all of it's going to work. So that's issue number one. Issue number two is in that tropical zone, we have massive monsoon pressure in the summertime. And so when I say massive, it's going to get like 4,000 millimeters of rain in the month of July.
In the month of July.
Yeah. I mean, when I say massive, it's like deluge every single day. And so we don't want that. So I don't know that we want to have the summer harvest. There's got to be a really, really great reason why we should have the second summer or the second harvest in the summer. My personal opinion is we probably shouldn't because of rain. And then I also have an opinion, which is shared by some of the folks in the scientific community and not shared by others. And my opinion is like, if you keep doing two harvests a year on your vines, you're going to burn them out. It's not good for the vines. Yeah. My opinion is that. Now, if you were to talk to some scientists about it, you'd get different opinions on whether or not that's a true statement. And you would also get different opinions on whether or not the summer harvest is better to retain or the winter harvest is better to retain. I have this practical situation with a fucking ton of rain in July, which sort of solves that problem for me. But within that, we're trying to figure this out through a regimen of experimentation and different grape varietals. Matter of fact, I have a container ship leaving the United States in about 8 days with a bunch of Grenache that we're going to try down there as well, because I want to kind of see how the Grenache stands up against that tropical.
I would have thought Grenache wouldn't do too well, because it's quite a thin-skinned grape variety, which means it's quite susceptible to mold and mildew, but it's quite well adapted for the heat.
Correct. Yeah. And so if we grow Grenache over the winter and then we prune it back and we don't let it flower in the summertime, we just let it rest in the summertime. In the winter, it's super, super dry and it's perfect climate for growing grapes. And so we're like, hey, maybe Grenache would be an amazing thing here, but we're going to have to be real careful to not let it flower in the summertime.
The other thing you mentioned was that the temperature gets to 45 degrees Celsius in the summer.
Yep.
The vine's going to spend a lot of time shut down. That's too hot for a vine to be photosynthesizing. It's just, they just can't get enough water up through the root ball.
Well, unless there's 4,000 millimeters of it falling from the sky.
It's just absorbing it from the atmosphere.
So like if you were to take and look at Gallifu and as a normal, regular vine grown region, you would immediately conclude that there's no possible way that you could grow grapes there. You would immediately conclude that. And when we first went to Bhutan, I immediately concluded that. And then we started thinking it through and we're like, hey, wait a minute. What if we do this instead? So we started trying it. We're about 7 years into this project. For about the first five, I was convinced Gallifu was not an option. And it was only in the last 2 years we're like, let's go and try this. And what we're seeing so far is incredibly promising, but it just requires a whole hell of a lot of interventionist farming methods to make sure that the summer doesn't get out of hand.
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned, you said pruning. How do you prune a vine? Because you can't really, you've got buds there. You can't get rid of all the buds, so, or else you won't have anything the following winter to burst into grapes. So how heavily do you prune it? Is it like a winter pruning, or is it even more severe than that?
It's even more severe than that. But we're also doing, we're also using this chemical called Dormex. And so because of that, you can sort of artificially control when the vine goes dormant and when it wakes up. So we are pruning, but we're not using pruning as the primary mechanism for controlling this.
Okay. Okay. And what does Dormex do? It sounds,
it basically
it stops it, but it, how and why?
It basically, you apply it and then the vine goes, oh, it's time to wake up. And so when you want the growing season to start, you apply Dormex. And then the vine goes, oh, okay, it's time to go. And then once it kicks off, then it just goes through its normal growing cycle. But you can, because you can decide when you apply it, you can artificially control when the cycle starts. So if I want the cycle to start in November, I can make the cycle start in November. If I want it to start in December, I can. We haven't figured it out yet, like when the optimal spot to start is. That's one of the things that we're working through today.
And obviously the wines you create, because you must be, after 7 years, you'll be making some wine. And I'm sure like every winemaker who owns it, it's all wonderful stuff. But is there anything particular about the wines that you're seeing coming through, or is it still too early days to get any feel for it?
So I said we've been at it for 7 years, but it took about two of those years to convince the country to even let us try to do this. So we planted the first vineyards in 2019, and then the pandemic happened. So we made our first batch of experimental wines just this past go round. I think the fermentation finished up kind of early October. The reds are looking extremely promising. I was in the country right prior to the fermentation, and I also thought that the Riesling and the Sauvignon Blanc grapes, the berries, were tasting just incredible. But I had to leave, and so I didn't get to taste the actual finished wine product. I'm going back in a couple months, and then I'll have my first sip of this thing that I've spent 7 years on and a ton of money to see, you know, if my intuition was correct. Yeah, everything is showing promise. Like I said, we'll probably find some stuff that just doesn't work, and I'm okay with that. I don't need every grape to work. I need to find the ones that do work and plant more of that.
Because of the high disease pressure you're encountering and the different difficulties, do you think Bhutan would become an area of wine a significant area of production, or do you think it's always going to be niche geared towards maybe the tourist industry and things like that?
No, I think, I mean, we can plant, I mean, our business model has us taking it to 2,000 acres over the next 4 years. I think long-term it could be a 30, 40,000 acre kind of place. The Himalayas in general are becoming a lot more interesting on the fine wine space because of global climate change. There are two companies right now that make Himalayan wine. Both of them are on the Chinese side. One of them is a company we've all heard of, LVMH. Their Himalayan wine sells for about $300 a bottle. The other company is a company called Dang Shen Di. They make two wines, one that's $500 a bottle, one that's $1,200 a bottle. So I think there is at least attention being paid to the quality that's coming out of the Himalayas. Whether or not we're going to be able to capture that, that's on us, right? But that's our plan. I mean, our vision is 20 years from now, I'd love to have a 20,000 acres of vines growing, you know, some of the world's finest wine. Mm-hmm. I think it's possible.
Just before we close up, you said that basically on the side of a mountain.
Yep.
Do you have a lot of vines on slopes, or have you chosen areas that are just a little bit flatter? And how, if it's on slopes, how does that lead through to mechanization and your costs associated with that?
The terrain in Bhutan is incredibly mountainous. Within that, you can find spots that are flat. I would say we have one vineyard that's completely flat, two vineyards that have big flat spots, and then we have some very steep, very mountainous vineyards as well. And it creates different sets of farming challenges. From a cost perspective and mechanization, the land in Bhutan it's free for all intents and purposes. And the labor costs are about $8 a day for very skilled, sustainable agronomists, world-class sustainable agronomists, $8 a day. So our cost structure is not the same as other regions. So I'm sort of less worried about, hey, how do we mechanize? Because I can just hire more agronomists.
And also because it's experimental, small size probably doesn't matter too much anyway, does it?
Yeah, with the experimental ones, I mean, our largest vineyard's 72 acres. Our next largest is 55 acres. And then we have these, you know, experimental vineyards that are as small as an acre, where we're trying different stuff out and seeing what works and what doesn't work.
What do you think the long-term situation is with Bhutan? Is it too early to say, look, we're going to have a wine industry here? Or do you think it's just too early for all that?
I think when you look at what they have done with other crops, I mean, they grow the world's best red rice. They grow the world's best cardamom. They grow the world's best mandarin oranges. They can grow some of the world's best wine grapes. It is up to us to figure out how to do that. And that means what altitude, what varietal, what farming methods, and whatever. That process of dialing that in could take 50 years. You know, we've taken a very long-term approach to this, and we've always said, you know, we're building this for our grandkids, and we're going to do our part to get it as far down the road as we can, and then we'll pass the torch, and the next guy will have to carry it. But yeah, I think long-term, there's no question in my mind that Bhutan is going to be interesting in the global fine wine scene.
All right then, Mike, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
All right. Cheers, Chris.